He's persistent. It's what makes him successful. Yet she takes care to introduce the testimony of three sons from his first marriage. His sons say they had a great father. To understand Sorel's persistence, consider how he pursued Falcone. She was born in Rome in February 1973, the daughter of an airline pilot and senior Alitalia executive. After receiving an MA from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, she worked for Shell and for the UN's International Labor Organization. She eventually joined the World Economic Forum as a senior manager and later director of the Media and Entertainment Industries Group, which coordinated with executives from these sectors who attended the World Economic Forum in Davos and elsewhere. When Sorel laid eyes on the tall, slim, vivacious blonde with an Italian accent and a feisty I-don't-bow-to-anyone personality, he was smitten. "For 4 years," she says, "he invited me to join him for a drink in Davos, and I did not go. He tried to convince me he was the right partner for me." She had a Swiss boyfriend, and she declined. When she attended the Cannes Film Festival, she left a general message on her office phone that she was in Cannes. He showed up there. He pursued her by appearing at forum meetings in South Africa, India, and Japan. Knowing that the Italian name her parents gave her was Savage, he says, "I named my dog, an Irish setter, after her." He wore her down. She worried about the 3-decade age gap, but was taken by his ardor and his charm. She says, "He listens very well. He takes it in. He's very inclusive." He treated her like an equal. They married in 2008. Charlotte Beers, who once reported to Sorel and remains a trusted associate, vividly recalls his bitter divorce in 2003, and how unhappy he seemed. She went off to work in George W. Bush's State Department and fell out of touch with Sorel. When they reconnected after his marriage to Christiana, she was struck by the change. "When I came upon him, he looked 10 years younger. He had a different energy. He had a delight in life. I think it's from having a very happy union. He is amused by it. He has a wonderful capacity for play. You'd never believe that because of how hard he works, but Christiana is a player. She likes to dance. She likes to go to unusual things. She lured him to attend Burning Man in the Nevada desert. She gave birth to their baby daughter in the fall of 2016. One can fill notebooks with the criticism heaped upon Sorel. But these don't paint a complete picture. If we just froze the picture when David Ogilvy called him an odious little shit, we would miss what happened next. After they met for the first time, Ogilvy wrote Sorel, "To my surprise, I liked you. I was flattered when you quoted my books, and even more so when you invited me to become chairman of your company, which goes by the name WPP. I accepted your invitation. It remains for me to tell you that I am sorry I was so offensive to you before we met." When Ogilvy was dying of cancer, Sorel visited him and promised to look after his wife. He did, and according to Miles Young, it was Martin who paid for Ogilvy's nurses. His image is as Genghis Khan of the ad world. But he's really very caring. When David Moore's wife was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2007 and was being rushed by ambulance to a New York hospital, Moore was in London. He told Sorel he had to rush back to the States to be with his wife. "When I landed, I had 3 voice messages on my mobile phone from doctors Martin had called. They called me to offer their services." Sorel's vivid personality can overshadow his professional accomplishments. He's gone to places no one has gone, Shelley Lazarus, who was CEO and is today chairman emeritus of Ogilvy, says. He's explored the future. He's taken chances. He thinks long term. Everyone thought he was crazy when he invested in his first research company. He was right. He diversified WPP. He invested in programmatic buying when no one was sure what it was or where it was going. He is constantly traveling, soaking up information, figuring out the next thing. The Harvard Business Review ranked him as the fifth best CEO in the world in 2015. The only other marketing holding company executive to make the list of 100 of the best performing CEOs was Maurice Levy. Sorrell had to be pleased that Levy only ranked 39th. In 2016, Sorrell was placed in the top three. All three were lauded for their courage in implementing long-term strategies. Whatever their differences, there are many shared views in the agency world. They commonly believe advertising and marketing should be viewed as an investment in growth, not just a cost. They share a frustration that too many clients, led by procurement and chief financial officers, focus on the short term. By wrenching costs out of marketing budgets, they complain that clients are crippling agencies and failing to invest in their brands. As Sorrell looks down the road, the two grave nemeses he sees to WPP's business are the digital giants, like Google and Facebook, and the consulting and software companies. This is particularly awkward since the holding companies place billions of dollars worth of ads with Google and Facebook, and often employ the services of consulting and software companies. This is why Martin Sorrell popularized the phrase frenemy to describe companies that both cooperate and compete. On this point, at least, there is no disagreement between Sorrell and Maurice Levy, who says they are now going directly to clients. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown, especially in an age of turmoil and revolution. 7. Frenemies. We are not trying to disrupt agencies. I know people don't believe that. Carolyn Everson. Carolyn Everson doesn't look like an existential threat or a frenemy, certainly not to Michael Kassin. Facebook's personable vice president of global marketing solutions evades the Facebook engineer cliches. No growling for her, no t-shirts and unwashed hair, no looking down at her shoes when she speaks. Her straw blonde hair is perfectly coiffed and curved into a helmet above her shoulders. Her neck and hands are friendly to jewelry. Her fashionable dresses might be featured in Vogue. Michael Kassin met Everson when she was COO and executive vice president of U.S. ad sales for Viacom's MTV networks, and has served as a mentor for nearly two decades. They met when he was moderating a panel at CES, and a debate between Everson and publicist executive Pam Zucker ensued about how best to massage and employ data. To add a touch of levity, Kassin borrowed what he thought was a familiar joke from Saturday Night Live. "Pam, what you're really saying is, Carolyn, you ignorant slut. You don't know what you're talking about." The audience laughed. Everson did not. The next morning, a Friday, a friend phoned Kassin and said, "You have a real problem with Viacom. You called Carolyn Everson a slut." The CEO of MTV lodged a formal complaint with CES. Chastened, Kassin phoned Everson and tried explaining that he had borrowed a line from one of the all-time most popular skits on Saturday Night Live. "You actually think I would call you a slut on stage?" Monday morning, when Everson arrived at work, she was greeted by a dozen roses and a signed note from Kassin. "Here's hoping I get a second chance at a first impression." He did, and says, "We became best friends." Carolyn and her older brother Bill grew up in the middle-class community of Stony Brook, Long Island, where their mother taught elementary school and their dad was a mid-level executive at Grumman. From a young age, she displayed the outgoing personality of a salesperson, taking part in ballet performances, public speaking, competitive sports, always eager to raise her hand in class, and always in the good graces of her teachers, her brother says. She received a full academic scholarship to Villanova. She didn't have a career plan, but she located one of many future mentors, sociology professor Bernard Gallagher, who was impressed by the three papers she wrote that were published in academic journals. He fervently recommended her when Arthur Anderson visited campus to interview seniors. After graduating summa cum laude in 1993, she was hired as an Anderson consultant. Her first task was to help Merck & Company and Astra smooth any kinks in a joint venture and to research strategic alliances. Demonstrating her knack for being adopted by mentors, she read a book by Robert Porter Lynch on strategic alliances, cold called him in Rhode Island, and recruited him to advise the two companies. He would serve as another mentor. Carolyn also became friends with a divorced Merck executive, Douglas Everson, a friendship that would blossom one day into romance. She left Anderson in 1995 to join Disney. By now, she was dating Doug, and they married in 1997. Knowing that her career path was business, her brother urged her to go to business school. Aware of her large ambitions, her Disney boss, Charles Adams, stepped in as a mentor. If you want to be a CEO or a general manager, the Harvard Business School is where you want to go. As an alumnus, he put in a good word for her. After graduating with honors, she held a number of executive jobs over the next several years, including the ill-fated Pets.com, followed by 2 years at Zagat and 3 years at Prime Media Inc., before joining Viacom. Then in 2010, with a nudge from Kasson, one of his consulting clients, Microsoft, offered Everson a position as vice president of global advertising sales and trade marketing teams in Seattle. After Everson received the offer, she turned to Kasson for advice. "Michael told me not to move to Seattle," she says. He wanted her to take the job, but persuaded her that the ad community she needed to work with was located in New York. Microsoft relented. Only 4 months later, a headhunter called and asked if she would meet with Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook. At first, she said no. Carolyn was really torn, Kasson recalls. "She's a very ethical and loyal person. But this was an opportunity of a lifetime." Eventually, she weakened, and on the way to Australia for Microsoft, she stopped in the valley on a Sunday to meet with Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg. She spent a full day at Facebook. "I knew in my heart that's where I wanted to be," she says. "It was so much more entrepreneurial. Advertising was the entire business of Facebook, whereas at Microsoft it was a tiny piece." Everson was the same age as Sheryl Sandberg, 40. And like her, was a former Baker Scholar at the Harvard Business School, and extremely well-connected. She consulted what she refers to as my board of directors for advice. They include Kasson and Wenda Millard, Erwin Gottlieb of Group M, Bill Koenigsberg of Horizon Media, Andrew Robertson of BBDO, Nick Brienne, now the CEO of Dentsu Aegis in the U.S., Jack Myers, chairman of Myers Biznet, and a prominent marketing consultant, and Terry Khawaja, CEO of Luma Partners, an investment banker. She also phoned Martin Sorrell for advice. These are hardly people hostile to the interests of the advertising establishment. 9 months after joining Microsoft, she departed for Facebook. No one played a larger role in her coming and going than the unofficial chairman of her board of directors, Michael Kasson. He provided one-stop service, for behind the scenes, she says he helped persuade his client, Microsoft, to let her go, and promoted her talents to another client, Facebook. "She absolutely worships Michael," says her husband, Douglas Everson, who would take early retirement at 60, after 3 decades as an executive at Merck, to care for their twin daughters when Carolyn's job at Microsoft and then Facebook required extensive travel. He says of Kasson, "He has been an amazing resource for Carolyn. Michael is like family to us." "As they are to Kasson, who treats me like his niece," says Carolyn. When one of Doug's 2 older sons from his first marriage had a child, they brought Kasson to the boy's bris. When the UJA Federation of New York Marketing Communications Division honored Everson and Rob Norman, Group M's global chief digital officer, in May 2016, and raised nearly $1 million, the dinner chair for the past 7 years and the person who selects the honorees was Michael Kasson, who also serves as the UJA's national co-chair of its Entertainment, Media, and Communications Division. the Pierre Ballroom was packed with advertising notables. For as Wendy Clark of DDB says, Michael has convening power. And when Everson rose to accept her honor, after thanking her family, she turned to offer a bow to Kasson. Michael, you took me under your wing. As Facebook's point of contact with agencies and advertisers, Everson receives high marks. Her enthusiasm and relentless optimism stand out. She's very collaborative. The collaboration she's driven at Facebook has set the tenor for others. She's a connector, Wendy Clark says. We are not trying to disrupt agencies. We are trying to help improve sales, Everson says. We are getting a seat at their table, helping them think through real business problems, and the faster we help them move to become more nimble and understand how mobile is impacting marketing, we will benefit in the end because they will invest more with us because we happen to have the dominant mobile platform. I don't go to meetings and ask for money. I don't think I've done that in 5 years. I know people don't believe that. By people, she means Martin Sorrell, who she believes, wrongly, stands alone in his wariness. We are not a frenemy, she says. Do you hear that coming out of John Wren? At least, not publicly. Martin Sorrell was becoming alarmed about Facebook in the winter of 2016. When told what Facebook said about not trying to disrupt agencies, he disputed the claim. They are not agnostic. They are selling Facebook inventory. He knows Facebook benefits from the growing mistrust advertising clients harbor toward their agencies. And he believes they are selling under false pretenses because they are not a technology company. They are a platform, a media company. You wouldn't give your media plan to Rupert Murdoch or Les Moonves or Bob Iger. So why would you give it to Mark and Cheryl? That's a fact. There's a subsidiary point. If that is Facebook's case, then give us your data, which they don't. He went on to say that he agrees with Facebook that what is crucial to know is the outcome of an advertising campaign. But the only way you can prove the outcome is through the data. Michael Kasson agrees that Sorrell is not alone among agency people who complain that Facebook is a frenemy. Increasingly, he says, clients feel more independent and consult with digital companies like Facebook with potentially ominous consequences for agencies. If you and I find out we speak the same language, why do I need a translator? Facebook is clearly competing for advertising dollars. Sometimes Facebook complements television, Everson says, because with TV viewing down among millennials, Facebook is great at finding that audience. But, she concedes, at the end of the day, we all compete for ad dollars. Where Sorrell is wrong, Kasson says, is when he objects to Facebook meeting independently with its advertisers by, in effect, exclaiming, "You can't go to my clients." Last time I checked, the 13th Amendment outlawed slavery in this country. Paranoia about Facebook's advertising intentions are ignited by several factors. By its size, by the walled garden it maintains when refusing to share much of its data, by the immense volume of data it gathers, and by fear that it aims to displace agencies. By 2015, Facebook's size as translated by its market cap or worth was equal to General Electric's. By 2016, its market cap zoomed past the world's fourth most valued corporation, ExxonMobil. By the end of 2016, Facebook collected $27 billion from ads and basked in profits of $10 billion. Facebook and Google's size advantage was revealed in the first quarter of 2016 when Mary Meeker of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers reported that of every new digital ad dollar, 85 cents went to Facebook and Google. Their digital dominance increasingly mattered because digital advertising by 2017 was expected to surpass the $70 billion spent on the number one U.S. ad platform, television. Monopoly fears magnified. Facebook and Google are a digital duopoly, Terry Khawaja says. They have two-thirds of mobile ad revenue, and it's growing. They have first-party data on people, which in a mobile world is the only way to identify people. They are sucking up all the oxygen. Shane Smith, co-founder, CEO, and driving force behind Vice Media, speaks in sentences followed by exclamation points and shouts fuck a lot. Facebook's power was a favorite exclamation. And after he boasted before an audience of Hearst executives in May 2016 that Vice was going to become the fourth largest or fifth largest or maybe the third largest media company in the world, he took aim at Facebook. This is the biggest problem of the world. Facebook has bought two-thirds of the new media companies out there without spending a dime because they own a majority of their mobile, and thus control access to media's content. Offering what he describes as a reality check, Randall Rothenberg, president and CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau, the trade association that represents digital companies like Facebook, says, "How different is it from when most advertising dollars were going to just three television networks?" Those who compete with Facebook believe it is different and feel especially vulnerable. Longtime digital executive Patrick Keane, former president of ShareThrough.com, where he sold the native ads of publishers to digital companies and worked with brand advertisers to link up with these digital publishers, does not hide his competitive fear of Facebook. "It's a Facebook world we all live in," he says, noting that Facebook and Google leave advertising pennies for other digital platforms. Facebook has this incredible, almost instantaneous, ability to be successful in anything. They turned their biggest liability, they were late to focus on mobile, into an asset almost overnight. Now they are trying to better compete with YouTube and video. And they've become a publishing platform with instant articles. This program, launched in 2016, allows publishers to display entire articles within the Facebook app in much the same form as in their home environment. Harry Cargman, founder and CEO of Cargo, a MediaLink client whose business mission is to create a mobile advertising platform to spread ad dollars to media company clients, is worried. He says, "The question is, what's Facebook's mission? Their mission is to get people to spend 100% of their time on Facebook. Their mission is to become the internet." If Facebook were to become the internet, the site people never leave, where they share pictures, IM, get their news, shop, search, watch television, and one day movies, it would create a nearly impregnable walled garden. And in the meantime, the complaint from both agencies and brands, which grew louder in 2016, was that Facebook, like Google, takes ad dollars but shields much of its data from advertisers, disabling them from targeting consumers on other platforms or in their future ad campaigns. "The less data we get from them, the harder it is for us to decide where to allocate our own dollars," says Rob Norman. The more information agencies can extract from Facebook about what else their users like and do, the more precise their ad targeting. Norman is clear about what agencies and clients want from digital companies that know much more about their users than do non-digital platforms like television, radio, or print. Comparing three digital giants, Facebook, Google, and Amazon, he says, "You could argue that Facebook has the best data on users based on their social interactions. You could argue that Google has the best because a search signals a person's intent. If you're thinking of purchasing intent, Amazon has the deep spear, which is actual purchasing data. Agencies and advertisers would like the data from all three. Facebook, Google, and Amazon have a financial incentive to safeguard this data. Their public defense is that they are protecting the privacy of their users and their pledge not to share names or personal information." The assertion that Facebook and Google compete with agencies gathered force in 2016. Agencies were agitated that neither Facebook nor Google shared data with measurement umpires like Comscore or Nielsen, which would have enabled an independent assessment of an ad's effectiveness. Martin Sorrell regularly accused Facebook and Google of seeking to grade their own homework. This fed into suspicions that their real aim was to displace agencies. Facebook and Google are also seen as poaching talent from agencies, Facebook hired a creative director from Saatchi & Saatchi to work for its own chief creative officer, Mark Darcy, who had spent 2 decades as a copywriter and as a chief creative officer for agencies and media companies. Darcy later hired Andrew Keller, former Crispin Porter and Boguski CEO, as global creative director of what it calls its creative shop. Everson demurs, saying, "We have zero interest in creating competition with agencies." Facebook employs a staff of 220 under Darcy and Keller, and their mission, Everson says, is to inspire the creative agencies, not compete with them. Few would see the line between inspiration and competition as being as clear and bright as Everson does. Certainly, Facebook's chief creative officer does not. Darcy concedes that his team does at times compete with agencies. He says Facebook partners with ad agencies 60% of the time, which of course means they don't 40% of the time. "We have absolutely no interest in serving as an ad agency," he insists. But he adds, "Nor do we think any business has a monopoly on creativity." Facebook's business is reliant on selling ad space, so of course Facebook pitches advertisers. Smaller advertisers routinely reach out to Facebook directly, as do many larger advertisers. Advertising Age reported that half of the top 50 global advertisers assign teams of their people to embed with Facebook and Google teams to figure out how to better reach their consumers. Facebook is not saying to us, "Why do you work with agencies?" says Anne Finucane of Bank of America. They are saying to agencies and to us, "Don't put up a brick wall between the client and us." We agree. But the agencies don't want this. The agencies make no less money, but they want control. For a company like Facebook that helps advertisers shape creative approaches to its users and seeks to better understand client needs, it is probably inevitable that they will usurp some agency functions, including that of go-to advisor. Each quarter, Facebook rents a large space in Manhattan and invites client and agency representatives for a full-day briefing on how mobile, and particularly mobile video, is the new frontier of advertising, the new television. The audience of 300 to 400 is dominated by people under 35. To emphasize the reach of mobile video, a Facebook executive told them, 100 million hours of video was watched daily on Facebook, more time than viewers spent before their TV sets. They screened an old Bulova Watch black and white TV ad as a warning that the ad formats and length, and how mobile ads were presented, had to be very different. They offered the testimony of Facebook advertisers who extolled the success of their Facebook ads. They invited to the stage Zach King, a young video star with 13 million Facebook followers, who describes how he became what is known as an influencer, casually selling products by integrating them into stories he told. They emphasized that video ads would fail if they didn't capture the attention of viewers quickly, certainly within the first 3 seconds, because you don't have the luxury of time on mobile. They spoke of Facebook's dynamic ads, which rely on algorithms to hyper-target ads to people whose Facebook data predicts whether they might be receptive. Everson closed out the day at 5:30 p.m. by telling her audience that a mobile phone is the most personal device people ever had. No other medium in marketing has ever been this personal. We carry it with us always, unlike a television set. We store our personal information and pictures and preferred apps on it. We don't loan the phone to others. And because a mobile phone is so personal, to be effective, ads can't feel like an interruption and have to be more personal. So my biggest point, Everson concluded, is that you have an opportunity to communicate to consumers in new ways that will evoke emotion and will drive business results. The entire day was an advertisement for why clients and agencies should divert ad dollars to Facebook. However impressed the audience was, and to a reporter individuals affirmed that they were, there are a couple of barriers Facebook won't easily scale. unlike agencies, Anfinuken says, they are not neutral. That is the core of what bothers clients. Objectivity is enormously important to us. Facebook is selling its own product, so how can they be objective? The same for Google. There are those in the ad business who foresee Facebook or Google trying to compete with Irwin Gottlieb's Group M as a buyer of media. But would a media plan drawn up by Facebook include a substantial buy for competitors like Google or Snapchat? The other barrier impeding direct Facebook competition, Andrew Robertson cautions, why would they trade their 40% profit margins for ours? At their peril, agencies forget that Silicon Valley companies like Facebook take pride in being disruptors, in reducing costs, and better serving customers by offering less friction and shoving aside what they see as superfluous middlemen. Mark Zuckerberg's famous corporate mantra at Facebook used to be, "Move fast and break things." In 2014, Facebook changed it to, "Move fast with stable infra," which doesn't have quite the same edge to it, no doubt deliberately. Unlike most agencies, Elliot Schrag, Facebook's vice president of global communications, marketing, and public policy, says, Facebook takes the Wayne Gretzky approach to business. Most businesses go where the puck is, where the business is today. Facebook is building a business for where the puck will be. Facebook, he says, does not aim to unseat agencies. However, certainly companies like ours will offer more and more tools. A glance at Facebook's history confirms that this is the opportunistic pattern the company has followed. Like Google and many internet enterprises, Facebook began with an aversion to advertising. From its launch in 2004, Mark Zuckerberg had what David Kirkpatrick, whose book The Facebook Effect offered the first definitive account of the company, described as ambivalence toward advertising. He accepted ads on Facebook only so he could pay the bills. Zuckerberg's priorities, user growth and a better customer experience, were more important than monetizing. It wasn't until he recruited Sheryl Sandberg away from Google to serve as his number two in 2008 that Facebook woke up. At Google, Sandberg oversaw its primary revenue source, online advertising sales. With Zuckerberg off on a month-long round-the-world trip, deliberately allowing Sandberg to establish her authority, she organized day-long executive meetings to figure out how to monetize Facebook's proliferating user base. With 250 million Facebook users at the time, the choice was clear. They emerged from these sessions and Sandberg told Kirkpatrick, "The revenue model is advertising." Like Mark Zuckerberg, Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin also formed their company with a belief that advertising was corrupting and would ill-serve users. In a paper they presented at an Australian web conference in 1998 that was unearthed by Tim Wu, they wrote that advertising-funded search engines will be inherently biased toward the advertisers and away from the needs of the consumers. Today, like Facebook, Google competes for ad dollars and the attention of clients. It performs services for advertisers, from targeting their dollars using its double-click automated buying, to designing search ads, to pitching that its YouTube is a more effective medium than standard television, to not charging advertisers unless an ad is clicked on, to offering data that highlights the user's intent, what they want, when they do a search. By the end of 2015, Google far eclipsed Facebook in the global ad dollars it amassed, $74.5 billion to Facebook's $26.9 billion. But Facebook ad revenues were growing faster. When Carolyn Everson joined Facebook in 2011, the company had about 500,000 advertisers. By March 2016, Sheryl Sandberg told an Advertising Week audience, 3 million advertisers flocked to Facebook, a number that 6 months later zoomed to 4 million and soon 5 million. Part of this extraordinary growth is a reflection of the expansion of the Facebook platform. The average Facebook user clicked on the site 150 times a day. and part is attributable to the company's ceaseless efforts to develop new tools for advertisers to target clients, resources unavailable to an advertiser who spent $5 million in 2016 for a 30-second Super Bowl ad and had to guess who watched it. Advertising is easy for Facebook's 5 million advertisers. Any company wanting to market a product can circumvent an agency and choose from multiple Facebook lead ads. Just click on the marketing message they wish to send, specify the amount they wish to spend, share their contact information for online customers, and specify the type of people they wish to reach. If they're unsure which marketing message might work best, the Facebook AI can test how well the message works. The Facebook software can also help choose the best targets. Companies can monitor the results hourly if they wish, and Facebook analyzes and shares the results of what marketing messages work and which don't. While Facebook shields some valuable data from advertisers, on its website it tells potential advertisers they can target audiences based on a variety of characteristics. In addition to age, gender, education, and job titles, their data offers personal interests, like hobbies or preferred entertainment, past purchase behavior, location, so an advertiser can choose where you want to do business, and they can even identify lookalike audiences with characteristics similar to those of the advertiser's customers. With that much data on its users, Facebook can target hundreds of thousands and even millions of users. At Facebook, we call it personal marketing at scale, Everson says. The definition of creative advertising has changed. It's not just Don Draper creating ads. Targeting and the technology that allows it becomes part of the creative recipe. By way of illustration, she recounted how Lexus launched a new Lexus NX model, a crossover SUV, in a 30-second ad for the 2015 Super Bowl, and also made this part of a larger campaign by creating unique video ads targeted to individual Facebook users. Instead of a single TV or print ad, working with Facebook, Lexus produced 1,000 different online advertisements. If you were a male living in Silicon Valley, or a female surfboarder living in Los Angeles, or a golfer, or you were a past Lexus owner, or planned to buy a car in the next 3 months, Facebook merged its anonymous user data with Lexus's, along with so-called third-party data they purchased. The result was tailored Lexus stories aimed at the interest of individual consumers. Everson reports to David Fisher, Vice President of Business and Marketing Partnerships, who has worked alongside Sandberg as her deputy at the Treasury Department in the Clinton administration, at Google, and now at Facebook. To facilitate better communication, Everson initiated a client council in 2011 composed mostly of major brand CMOs like P&G and Unilever, along with some top agency executives, and a creative council in 2012 composed of creative agency executives. Each meets quarterly, and sometimes, as in Cannes in June 2016, they meet jointly. At the Cannes Quarterly in 2016, Everson stood at the front of a large, majestic hotel conference room wearing a white dress with large blue pearls circling her neck. In a strong voice that did not need a microphone, she welcomed the 40 or so client and agency representatives whose chairs were arranged in a large rectangular pattern with only carpet between them. She began with a status report, first mentioning a plan for a September session to which she was planning to invite several upstart companies that aimed to disrupt various industries, her hope being that those in attendance might better understand how disruptors think, and this might spark ideas about how to face future threats. She thanked the assembled for the fact that both quarterly councils offered early warnings that they were missing mobile, spurring Facebook to move aggressively into mobile. With alacrity, Facebook shifted from a desktop to a mobile company, and today mobile provides over 80% of its ad revenue. She offered an update on some of the council's other past suggestions. "You told us to get serious about emerging markets. Since then, we've opened 60 offices around the world. They warned that video worked great on mobile devices with 4G. But what if users were on Facebook with a 2G mobile device or even a feature phone? So Facebook created a slideshow format that glided effortlessly across the screen. They complained that Facebook felt like a walled garden, so we started giving you more data. She updated them on some Facebook numbers. Its Instagram photo sharing site has reached 588 million users, having doubled in the past 2 years, and 68% of its users visited on a daily basis. The total time spent watching Instagram video has grown 150% in 6 months. Its Messenger IM was now used by 900 million people, up from 150 million in 2 years. Facebook had 158 million users in India, and it would not be long before India passed the United States 203 million. Brazil was not far behind with 110 million users. She invited Graham Mudd, Director of Monetization Product Marketing, to discuss what Facebook was doing to improve how it measured the effectiveness of client marketing efforts. A key thing to measure, he said, is whether the message is engaging to the potential consumer, not just whether it gets a click. To decipher that, Facebook was trying to gauge the emotional connection to the marketing message and the attention it gets by measuring the time spent with the message and contrasting this with the average time each individual usually spends with other ads or content. They measure whether the person presses the like button or shares the message with friends. They have made good progress on measuring attention, the easier of the two. They learned, for example, that millennials and teenagers consume content 2.5 times faster than older people. And the larger the screen, the more time they spend with videos, meaning that to accurately measure attention, they needed to know the device the person was using. In general, if the message kept the person's attention for at least 2 seconds, that was probably a good sign. Though just 2 seconds probably skews the audience as younger. If the person spent more than 3 seconds, 85% were likely to stay for a 30-second message. They had the data to compare whether the time spent with an ad was longer than the time the user spent with other ads. What they are also able to do is target what type of people actually pay attention to that type of ad. Thus, you can stipulate to us that you want to reach 10 million people, and we can target the right 10 million people. A CMO asked if the varied tools Facebook was creating could be shared and integrated so clients could use the data on other digital platforms. A Facebook executive admitted, "For us, this is a hard one." Performance data could be shared, he said. But since there was no universal platform on which all data could travel, because companies employed their own formats, shared data was illusory. What the Facebook executive did not say was that since they don't like to share some data, and since they were so dominant, Facebook had no interest in a universal platform. The tension over data sharing between Facebook and agencies and advertisers did not disrupt this meeting, though it might have. As noted earlier, a reason clients and their agencies grouse about Facebook's walled garden is because they want information about consumers that Facebook is unwilling to share, including targeting data they could utilize for non-Facebook ad campaigns. Facebook refuses to allow its users to be targeted on non-Facebook platforms, for that would weaken Facebook's leverage. Facebook says its bigger concern is that agencies and their clients are asking them to share personally identifiable information about Facebook users, the names and emails and phone numbers that would allow advertisers to track them and serve them marketing messages. Facebook says that would violate their privacy pledge to users. Advertisers deny they would ever ask for personally identifiable information. They each exaggerate their virtue. Council members are generally appreciative of these gatherings. The Facebook Council, I was there from the beginning. This is the most clever idea, Keith Weed of Unilever says. This is Carolyn Everson's baby. You get all the leading clients and agencies in a room, and they're very open about what they're trying to do, and Facebook gets feedback. It's free consulting with all the people who really matter. But one is never far away from the frenemy issue. One agency attendee who did not wish to be named said afterwards, "This is the greatest grin fuck." To grin fuck is to keep smiling when you're fucking us. He believes Facebook is conditioning clients to believe Facebook has all the answers, which one day might lead clients to abandon their agencies. There are many complaints about Facebook ads. In late 2015, James Murdoch, the CEO of 21st Century Fox, questioned the value of Facebook's video advertising formats, insisting that when Fox sold a product placement to Pepsi for $20 million and integrated its soft drink into the plot of its hit series Empire, it was a lot more effective than a two-second viewable in the corner of a screen as you scroll through your Facebook feed. I feel like those sorts of impressions are not really earning anybody's attention. Maybe not their attention, but certainly Facebook's, because these ads provide lucrative ad dollars. In early 2016, Patrick Keane, a Facebook competitor, extended Murdoch's argument. A huge percentage of Facebook's revenue is sort of the underbelly of the internet. Just direct response, shitty stuff. Punch the monkey stuff, silly ads. They're just trying to get users to download and engage. And they're able to do it because it's quantifiable. If it's on the screen for a second, it counts. There's no outside referee that certifies that it worked. Keane's argument dovetailed with a view repeatedly expressed by Martin Sorrell. It troubled him that clients were paying for ads that often were not viewed by human beings but rather by bots or automated software. There's no way a three-second view on Facebook, and 50% of the time the sound is turned off, can be equated to a 30 or 60-second TV commercial, Sorrell complained publicly. Unverified ads are a burgeoning challenge for Facebook and Google. So too are efforts by agencies and clients to boost strong digital competitors to the two giants. Their private agenda was not unlike that of 19th century Austrian Chancellor Metternich, who maintained the balance of power by building up other nation-states to help resist Russia's expansion. Some of the other dominant digital companies are not legitimate rival advertising platforms. Apple relies not on advertising, but on the sale of its hardware and software, and on an iTunes subscription model for music and the sale of apps. At the moment, Amazon's and Microsoft's business models rely little on selling ads. Twitter is ad-reliant, but Twitter has never earned a profit. By late 2015, many agencies and clients hoped two digital competitors might bust out. AOL, which was armed with new financial resources when Verizon decided it was too risky to be a dumb pipe and acquired AOL in May 2015, or Snapchat, an emerging social network Facebook competitor. With AOL and the Huffington Post providing content, and Verizon providing the pipe and data on its 135 million telephone customers, AOL CEO Tim Armstrong boldly proclaimed to an Advertising Week audience in September 2015 that the new entity has dreams of being the largest mobile media company in the world. The competitive target, he said, was Google and Facebook. The co-founder and CEO of Snapchat, Evan Spiegel, openly aspires to disrupt Facebook, which he mocked as passé. If you look at the next generation of social media, it's really pinned on this concept of instant expression, Spiegel said over breakfast at Manhattan's Four Seasons Hotel in October 2015. And it was only technically possible with the advent of the smartphone because you have a camera connected to it. People underestimate this transformation. So you can express yourself in real time in the moment. So you no longer have this weird phenomena, which is really what Facebook is built on, which is that you collect all these experiences and you upload them later. So on Instagram, you see these photos 3 days later. On Snapchat, you see snaps the moment they are created. Martin Sorrell decided in 2016 to ride the Snapchat horse as a rival worth betting on. he decided to sweeten the ad dollars WPP earmarked for Snapchat. "It does become a threatening alternative to Facebook," he told CNBC, "and I think that's the big opportunity for them. I think Facebook is concerned about the potential opposition." Not that concerned. Sorrell's threat was pure bluster. Although WPP would over time double the ad dollars it steered to Snapchat, from $90 million in 2016 to $200 million in 2017, it was akin to throwing pebbles in the ocean. WPP's ad spending on Google rose five times as fast in 2016, totaling $5 billion. WPP purchased $1.7 billion of ads on Facebook in 2016. While Snapchat's revenues jumped seven times faster in 2016, they only reached $404.5 million. By contrast, Facebook's ad revenues totaled $27 billion that year. The looming threat to Facebook and Google, which would prompt Sorrell and the agencies and their clients, as well as Facebook and Google, to quake, would not come from Snapchat. It would come from Amazon. 8. The rise of media agencies. We always had the view that the less a media owner knows about what our objectives are and what our needs are, the more leverage we have in a negotiation. If he knows what I need, why would he discount it? Irwin Gottlieb. In Hollywood, if you utter only certain first names, Warren or Barbara or Jeffrey, the film community knows you mean Warren Beatty, Barbara Streisand, or Jeffrey Katzenberg. In the advertising community, if you say Irwin, people know you mean Irwin Gottlieb, the global chairman and architect of Group M, the powerful media agency. Michael Kasson refers to Irwin as my closest friend, usually speaks to him at least once a day, and says of him, "In our industry, Irwin Gottlieb is Yoda." Comparing media agencies to creative agencies, Gottlieb's boss, Martin Sorrell, says, "Media agencies are better compensated than creative agencies. The engine room of WPP is the media agency's billings. Of the many companies that fly the WPP flag, Group M is the largest single profit contributor. And media agencies were the target of John Mandel's attack on the holding companies. Traditionally, a media agency supervises marketing campaigns, planning strategy, targeting where ads will appear, negotiating ad rates, and buying ads or promotional messages on media platforms. By the end of 2015, the foremost competitors to Group M were the media agencies of Publicis, Omnicom, Dentsu, IPG, and Horizon. Group M has 10 companies under its wing, including Mindshare, the biggest of its four media planning and buying entities, and Axis, the world's largest programmatic buying arm. Together, Group M's companies lavished on various platforms a total of about $75 billion advertising dollars, which in 2015 represented almost one-fifth of all global ad dollars. Group M is paid primarily on what is known as scope of work, or SOW, which means the agency submits how it will staff the account, and the client approves a pre-agreed profit margin, one that goes up or down based on the success, the key performance indicator, or KPI, of the campaign. Generally, Group M's profit margins are a couple of percentage points higher than WPP's 17.4%. In appearance, Irwin Gottlieb looks as if he just slid out of a barber's chair. Not a silver or black hair is out of place. He keeps it swept back at the sides and combed flat atop his head, like the deck of an aircraft carrier. He wears tailored suits, and if not adorned with an expensive tie, the top two buttons on his starched shirt are open just so. He speaks slowly, as if inspecting each word. This very careful man has traveled a long circuitous path from his birth in Dalian, China, formerly Port Arthur. His parents, Ginya and Jacob, were refugees from Belarus who after World War I separately traveled by train across Siberia to China, because Japan allowed Jews to relocate to Japanese-occupied China, and each had relatives who had immigrated there. His mother's family fled to Harbin, seeking business opportunity. Jacob followed a more circuitous route. His parents died when he was young, and as a child he joined the youth organization of Zev Jabotinsky, the commander of Beitar, a radical Zionist organization that was at war with the British who occupied Palestine. By 18, Jacob Gottlieb was a fervent Zionist serving in the Polish army, and, according to his son, was deemed a troublemaker as a Zionist and had to get out of the country. Desperate, Jacob tried to flee from Poland to Palestine, but was blocked. He came to Harbin seeking safety. Jacob and Genya met and married in China. Erwin was born in June 1949, and in 1950, Erwin and an older sister and their parents boarded a coal tanker that was retrofitted to sardine 1,600 refugees. The journey took 6 months to reach Israel, where his father's brother owned movie theaters and meatpacking plants. Erwin says his father came to Israel carrying precious stones, and had managed to bring on the boat 13 crates containing crystal and silverware, and even a refrigerator, half of which he traded to Chinese officials in order to escape China. He kept the good stuff, Erwin says. To this day, it's a mystery how his father collected this haul. This is hearsay. I never got it from him because there were things the man would not talk about. He's uncertain how his father, though 37 at the time, not only wasn't in the Israeli military reserves, but had been excused from service. From what I was told, he made a deal to serve in the foreign ministry for a year without pay in return for a deferment of his reserve duty. He knows this wasn't the total truth. Nor does he know why his father flew alone to Tokyo in 1952, and 3 months later summoned his family to join him at their new home in Kobe, Japan, where he had started a thriving pearl and diamond business. Jacob Gottlieb, his son says, did other things that were strange. He maintained an apartment in Tel Aviv and would regularly fly there and visit his good friend, Menachem Begin, who had been the commander of Irgun, the clandestine underground militant organization that grew out of Jabotinsky's Beitar. His dad was stubborn and difficult, and Erwin was closer to his mother. "My mom was the brilliant one," Erwin says. "She was an incredible mathematician and pianist. She pushed me on both. She made him practice piano 3 hours a day, and by the time he was 13, I was concert level. The day after his bar mitzvah, he stopped playing. He resumed in 2014. A precocious student who skipped grades, Erwin learned to speak 9 languages, and by age 15, his parents decided to send him to college in the United States. He came to New York and enrolled at New York University. But he never attended and never told his parents. Like his father, he lived a double life. For the next several years, they thought I was in school. What did he do? I partied a lot. He got a job in the media department of Norman Craig and Kummel. He met Elizabeth Billick at Fridays, a popular singles bar on East 61st Street and First Avenue. Much like he would later do in shrewdly negotiating advertising deals, he asked for her phone number, but waited 3 weeks to call. Why? I didn't want to show my cards. They've been married 48 years and have a daughter and 2 grandchildren in California. Erwin worked for a variety of agencies. His second ad job was at SSC&B, followed by Associate Director of Broadcast Programming at Benton & Bowles in 1977. He grew deeply frustrated by the parochialism of America and the advertising industry. "In the 70s, I was a closet sushi eater," he says. He'd sit at the bar of a sushi restaurant on West 48th Street and be the only non-Asian in the restaurant. "The United States has historically been a very parochial country," Gottlieb says. "We're an island. were separated from the rest of the world. And there was this attitude at Benton & Bowles in the mid-80s that London was a branch office. The difference in my DNA was that I always knew there was a very large world out there. In 1989, Benton & Bowles changed his title to Global Head of Broadcasting. He left in 1993 to found and serve as CEO of MediaVest Worldwide, the first time a U.S. media department was spun out as a standalone company. Martin Sorrell recruited him in